the Alton Browncast, still recording, or recording once again from my fabulous hotel suite here at the Monterey. What is this? The Monterey Bay Plaza, something or other. It's pretty cool. I'm in Monterey for the Cooking for Solutions event at Monterey Bay Aquarium, the leading force in sustainable seafood in the United States. Brings in a lot of culinary folk. Some of them you heard of, some of them maybe not so much. But sitting with me right now is somebody who probably doesn't need much of an introduction, but I'll give him one anyway. Jonathan Sawyer, chef, restaurateur, entrepreneur, father, owner of chickens. You own a chicken named Squid.
Well, we have two kids, Ketcher and Louisiana, and they named four of the six chickens, and Amelia and I named one. So Bunny, Bear, Squid, Acorn, Ginger, and Trout. And Trout is the one that I named after Kilgore Trout from Breakfast of Champions.
From Breakfast Champions.
Of course. And all the rest just came from wherever the mind's eye went with the kids.
Do you often reach for Vonnegut characters when you're naming things?
Honestly, I did want to name my daughter Von. I wanted to name her Vonnegut, but, you know, as my wife says, I wear the pants, she picks them out, though.
Oh. I don't know if I don't, women of America, don't get any ideas. I don't know that I like the way that sounds very much. So definitely as far as like your literary influences, you put Vonnegut up there, Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah, oh my gosh. Vonnegut, of course, Kerouac, love him. You know, Salinger, Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah, you got the entire cover of the hardback edition of Catcher in the Rye splayed out there on your forearm, your right forearm.
Yeah, Bradbury, I love, huge influence on me.
I'm still a little, oh my gosh, I just reread Fahrenheit 451, and I was like, oh my gosh, this used to be science fiction. Now it's like what happened yesterday. It's yesterday's news, and I'm like still depressed about it.
They
I don't know if I'm glad.
Retitle the book, The FCC.
Yeah. Well, gosh, all right, now I got to edit this thing. Now we're going to hear a helicopter. The next helicopter you hear, okay, that's not sightseeing, okay?
And they're not going to cane us either.
They're not going to cane us. It'll be like Tony Stark's house in Iron Man 3. They're just going to blast this place off of the side of the planet. You and I met. Do you remember when we actually met?
Yeah, it was the winter, the blustery winter of Cleveland 2007.
It was indeed. It was indeed. Well, we also we met. Well, by the time we knew each other, we did Iron Chef together first, and that's where we actually met, because you were part of the Michael Simon Empire,
the
Simon crew. Of course, he now owns the entire state of Ohio. And then that night at your restaurant, at the tavern, I still put that down as one of my top 10 favorite meals of all time. And I'm not gonna lie to you, it wasn't just because the food was incredibly good.
It was great company.
It was really good company. I was there with Michael Ruhlman. Mm-hmm. I love that downstairs area there at the restaurant. But I got to tell you, what put it over the edge for me was the eggnog.
It was the vintage eggnog.
The idea, you know, this is kind of crazy talk. I mean, nobody was really doing that back then. And people that were doing it, and what we're talking about, by the way, is I'm an eggnog. I don't mind using the word. Well, if you're an addict, does that mean that you have to get it and get it on a daily basis? Or probably is. Because I don't mainline or anything.
Do you mix it ever? Do you 50-50 it? Or?
Yeah, I sometimes do. Yeah, I'm not going to get into that. But let's just say that I am I'm an eggnog enthusiast of the first order. And you, before anybody else I knew was doing it, you were aging it. I mean, people were barrel aging cocktails by then, and that was, you know, just starting to really become kind of a thing. When did you start doing that?
You know, actually, oddly enough, it was inspired by a Michael Ruhlman blog post I had read about, you know, families who mother their gravies year after year after year. Mm-hmm. So you always have a bit of great-great-great-grandma Segedie's gravy in your Christmas gravy. If you just save a little bit and recycle it back in, the inspiration.
He was talking about freezing it, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I just really, something about the romance of holding something that long and recycling it and keeping it going and made me want to do these three different eggnogs.
But what he was talking about is an emotional thing. Do you believe that there's actually a culinary benefit of I mean, it's not, there's nothing alive in there. There are no enzymes. Everything's shut down.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's more of an emotional, sentimental kind of
thing.
What's going on in the eggnog is science.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that there's some of that You know, some of that old fashioned know-how does have a little basis in science, you know, like the, you know, the copper in the octopus or the cork in the calamari, you know, whether you believe it or not, I think it's an interesting thing to harken back to the tradition.
And there's
of
value. And there's value in it because of that. Well, yeah. But your eggnog was different.
Very different. Very different. So, I mean,
why did you start with what made you all of a sudden? So you read Ruhlman's thing about the gravy.
And we're hitting the Christmas season a couple years prior to when you came. Maybe just a full year, maybe 2 years.
Yeah,
I don't remember
how. You haven't been at it that long. Did you do research and find that there had been other people that had been aging eggnogs?
Not really, but what I wanted to see was what level I had to take the alcohol in order for it not to sour. You know, and my rule of thumb with that was always sort of the opposite of my rule of thumb for vinegar. I wanted to make sure that was above 17% alcohol. And then other than that, I thought it was, you know, super important to keep the sun, the light out of it and keep it airtight and keep it very still. You know,
why still?
Well, if you were to agitate, you know, and some of the milk solids were to hit the cap, they would have a better opportunity, being exposed to the elements as they were, to turn in the not fun direction of fermentation. So
rancidity or bad fermentation, all of it. But if you've got 17%+ alcohol content, what fermentation is even going to happen?
Well, the sugars and the lactic acid that are inside of the milk and the eggnog and the eggs that are in there as well are going to change over this time period.
A lot of that's from enzymatic change, is it not? Fair amount?
I think so.
Yeah, what's the organ called? It's in enzymatic change. But so what you find is that after – have you now found – because when I tasted there at the restaurant, you were still looking for ideal.
Right.
And you weren't perfectly happy with everything. I was perfectly happy with everything, but you didn't seem to be perfectly happy. Have you now struck upon it? Well, good.
Perfect happiness is not to ever be had.
Do you think you found the right percentages and the right time?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I enjoy the Scotch one the most for my own person, like a sherry cask, La Santa, very clean, very bright. There's also some of that romance back to the eggshells used in the process of making sherry that makes the barrel that gets to the Scotch eventually. This is also inside of the eggnog. So that's the one that I enjoyed the most. I do keep it around 17%. I don't like too much more alcohol than that in the nog.
Well, things get crazy.
Yeah.
And how long?
1 year is enough. You know,
thank God for that.
We have a couple that are 2 and 3 years old that are strictly for consume on a need to know basis. So
understood.
We would, you know, we've made pot au crèmes of them before, and they turn out fascinating. You know, like a vintage eggnog pot au crème.
Fascinating is not always good.
Not always good. Yeah,
that could be bad. Fascinating. Yeah. So you found that a Scotch based
sherry cask to like a 17% alcohol. And I honestly like – we've made it with our own eggnog, but I really like the product that Hartzler's, a nice grass-fed dairy from northern Ohio, uses. I think it has the most consistent and wonderful results. So we actually don't make the nog anymore. We buy the Hartzler's nog, and then we fortify it, and then we age it.
So it's basically mix this with that into these jars.
Into the jars,
glasses, and then
glass lid. Paper bag the outside, put it somewhere no one's ever going to touch it.
For a year.
Yeah.
At standard refrigerator temperatures, I mean, 38 to 40 is what we're talking probably.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, 36 to 38 maybe.
36 to 38 is probably more likely, yeah.
You seem to have a you brought me some vinegar. Johnny brought me vinegar from Tavern. And I have to tell you that the last time that when you were on Iron Chef – I stole all the leftover bottles that came back to the kitchen,
good.
Including a couple that I think that you probably had actually meant to take back with you that were like experimental. I took them. I took them all. I waited till you were gone, so I knew you weren't coming for them, and then I stole them. And I actually still have some of your vinegar from that that I've you know, it's special stuff.
Yeah.
You and I are both big fans of fermentation and
love
the natural
it.
Processes they go on. Tell me your vinegar story, because it's not everybody makes vinegar, and most people don't know how and don't care how. How did it happen?
I mean, I think like every artisan, it came initially out of inspiration to want to have a better product and maybe disdain for a product that I had purchased that I didn't think was worth it. You know, I just didn't understand why I could buy you know, a world-class California Cabernet, but I couldn't buy a world-class California Cabernet vinegar. I didn't understand why we weren't producing these things.
It's because there's no market demand for them.
Maybe there wasn't.
Yes, you know? But not big enough for most makers, I think.
You know, and I just think balsamic had this huge stranglehold in the market, and it was a really, as much as I love it and as much as I love Italy and the consortium of Modena, it's a very monochromatic product. I mean, the flavor is super complex, but you're talking about only slight variations between silver label, gold label, and there's only so many applications that you can afford to use that for.
I vastly prefer a Spanish sherry vinegar to balsamic vinegar.
Absolutely.
I've just had too much of it. I'm burned out. Yeah. Serve me some in 10 years and we'll talk.
Yeah. I mean, on a piece of stone fruit, you know, roasted in a wood-fired oven, that's it for me.
Okay.
For balsamic.
Yeah,
but
it's about
we
done.
Don't even buy vinegar anymore. I mean,
why would you?
We buy distilled vinegar to clean plates. That's it. So 11 odd years ago, I bought a bottle and it was relatively expensive for me and I wasn't happy with the product. And then I read the ingredients and there was caramel color in it. And I just said, this is ridiculous. I mean, I'm going to make my own vinegar. And I started reading and, above my stove in a relatively hot, dark, atmosphere, I started three vinegars. One was red wine, one was white wine, and one was beer.
Where did you get your mother's?
I didn't get a mother.
Yeah.
We just let it all, you know, in that crazy, either, you know, work and be beautiful or romantic fool heart. I just said I'm going to let it be natural. I want it to be, honestly, like a fingerprint. You know what I mean? I want it to be representative of our terroir. You know, even though it was a Brooklyn apartment and then it was a Century Home and Shaker and then it was, you know, the back room of a bourbon distillery in Columbus, Ohio. All those flora and fauna have contributed to what the vinegar is now. And there's never been, you know, a yeast purchase. There's never been a sugar purchase. None of that is really interesting to us. What we're interested in is letting the natural wines and beers turn into what they're going to turn into. You know, we will add water if the wine is too hot, you know, alcohol-wise. If we have like a, you know, if we purchase a 15.9 or we purchase a 15.2% alcohol wine, we'll take it down to 12 or, you know, 11.
That's easy, though. That's just math. That's
yeah.
Volume. It's
yeah.
Not a big deal.
And we could take it all the way down to 3%. You know, that acetic reaction happens all the way down from our experiments to like 3.1% alcohol.
And it tastes different depending on.
It does.
Because you get different levels of that reaction.
And we actually find with beer, the lower alcohol that we brew, the better the vinegar is because there's more consumable sugars, proteins, carbohydrates. It's a more complex – assuming you're brewing a great beer, you know, still at that low alcohol percent, there's so much more left inside that beer for the acetic reaction and the Scooby to consume. It's a way different beer.
Scooby?
Scooby. That's my favorite. You know, system of coexisting organisms, bacteria and yeast.
It's a very – fun term to me. Do me a favor. Walk these listeners through the easiest recipe for making vinegar that they could possibly attempt.
Sure.
If you don't mind.
I would love to. Honestly, I think the most fermentable or the easiest acetic reaction you can achieve is with beer. There's a lot for it to eat. You know,
there's
just
a lot
like
going on in there.
Yeah, it's just like yogurt, just like cheese, just like salumi. These are all the same sort of processes. You know, they have their own particular room that they like. For vinegar, it likes to be warm. You know, you want it to be definitely above 60 degrees. It
acetic
really likes to be 80 to 100. Yeah. If you go above 115, you'll kill it, but there's not many rooms in your house, I hope, that are above 115 degrees.
Not currently.
Maybe the attic in Atlanta in the summer, which isn't going to kill it. It's just going to slowly sort of take out the weaker yeasts and organisms. So, anyway.
Because we're talking about a lot of different critters. We're
There's not just one. I think people.
Acetic bacteria, I mean, we often say is what's doing all the work.
Right.
But it's not really the case.
Yeah. So.
Okay, so beer.
So anyway, so we buy beer.
What kind of beer are we talking about? If somebody's going to do this and they've never done it before, what kind of beer?
I would.
Or what type of beer?
I would recommend something a little bit more deep in body, like a Belgian ale or an American strong ale or a stout or a wheat beer. Okay. I wouldn't do like an IPA or like a super tongue ripper IPA from California, which is great to drink or whatever, but it doesn't really make the best vinegar. I don't like the reaction that hops typically have with vinegar. We still produce them. We do an IPA. I think people love it. It's a very popular style of beer, so it's a very popular style of vinegar. But anywho, so you start with this liquid. Okay, you essentially decant it. You know, so open it up, pop it into a glass container that's slightly wider than you would want. Like, you don't want to put it in a – you don't want to keep it in the beer bottle. You want a lot of surface area.
So let's make
like
a big old pickle jar or
something
like that. There
you go. Exactly. Like a big mason jar, a big pickle jar. Okay. You cover the top with cheesecloth or a clean rag, and then you put it in a space that is not going to be really disturbed too often. Now – I like to go above my stove because I have one of those little cabinets that has the flue around it because it's nice and warm. It's super dark. There's no reason for anyone to go up there. If you have a cellar, even though the temperature is cold, it's a great place because technically there's always some sort of unique flora and fauna to your basement that lives inside of the woods and the stones and the cracks of your basement, assuming you live in a century home. And then you just let it sit there. Okay, I like to go at least 4 months before you even think about touching it. You could probably go 6 months. And what we did in the beginning was we would smell it without opening it. We just give it a sniff. And if we can smell the acidity,
Vinegar.
Mm-hmm. So we would take a pH strip, we put it in there, and we want it to be below 4.5. Now, that's just for safeties. That's just for posterity. We like to take ours.
These strips, by the way, you can get it like swimming pool places. This is easy stuff to get. Certainly on the internet. You can get it from Amazon.com probably.
Yeah, they're probably 4 cents a piece, the pH strips. I mean, they're as foolproof as you could ever imagine.
Now, just for those of you that aren't too pH savvy, 4.5 is relatively acidic. Mm-hmm. It's not like, battery acid acidic, but it's pretty acidic, enough to keep out most of the types of pathogens that we would be afraid of.
Yeah, and actually 4.5 is the USDA recommended food safe level for vinegars.
Yep.
We take ours down even further, though. We have ones that go all the way down to 2.9.
Which is pretty
– that's clinical acidity.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I like because I like the control to be in the cook's hands, whether it's the home cook, whether it's the sous chef, whether it's – the foodie, whoever it is, I like the control to be in their hands. And what people think of when they think of, cooking, a lot of times they just think, oh, I'll just reduce it and it'll get stronger. That's not the case.
No.
That's not the case with vinegar. Okay. So
why not?
Well, the acidity is going to stay the same no matter where you reduce it to. So you can use less and you can blend it with something else to change the acidity in the overall, let's just say vinaigrette, because it's the most relatable for everybody, or ceviche, you can change that acidity by using less of the vinegar or using, a little more orange juice, as opposed to the lime juice. I think that's maybe what you can think of when you're thinking about acidity at home, take a lick of a lime, a lemon, an orange, a grapefruit. All four of those have very different pHs, orange probably being the most basic of all of them.
I would say. And we say basic, we mean the opposite of acidic.
Yeah. And then there's also that whole labeling thing, too, which I think is interesting. People started putting the percentage of acidity, which is a stat. I don't know what that means, but I do understand pH.
Yeah.
So that's it. So once you have it at that level, what I like to do is I like to pipe ours out because I like to keep the mother in there. Our process is pretty basic, not basic as in the pH.
Basic simple. As in elementary, as opposed to base.
So we just take liquid and we pour it. We don't use plastic for any of our processes. We've always been 100% oak glass. Or glass. Oak glass. That's it. I know that there's food safe plastics out there. I just don't believe it. So someone could probably prove me wrong. But anywho, we like to pipe out 80% of the vinegar and leave the rest in there. So
you're piping it out from all the way at the bottom or mid vessel?
We like it to be like mid vessel. If you're all the way at the bottom, you'll get some refuse, which is just
sediment.
Sediment,
dead
excrement, dead yeast. Nothing wrong with it. Probably great for you.
Dead critters and poo.
Dead critters and yeast poo.
Which somebody in California is already selling, I feel certain.
Yeah.
In Southern California.
Yeah, it's my new pomade is made out of yeast poo.
Perfect.
So we leave 80% in there, and then we always keep the same varietal to go back in, or we go darker in color. Because the Scooby or the mother or the leftover product that's left in your barrel or your mason jar is going to take on the color of the liquid it is.
Sure.
So if it's a champagne, it's going to be crystal clear. If it's a red wine, it's going to be dark. If it's a Merlot, it's going to be super dark, So we always like to go darker in color if we're changing liquids. We don't often change liquids in barrels.
Because once the mother's proven, in one liquid. Yeah. Why challenge the colony, so right. to speak?
And why mess with the color? There's no reason, you know, like this all comes back to that moment where I read, you know, caramel food coloring. Like there's, I want it to be, if it's an oxidized Chardonnay, you know, like the one that you have there, mm-hmm. it's almost brown. And I'm okay with that color.
It should be. That's the real color.
That's what our mother did to that vinegar.
So a lot of the people that are going to be listening to this, despite your efforts and mine, will have absolutely no idea what a mother is, other than somebody who thinks you don't call often enough. We're talking about a mother. We're talking about these organisms create a raft, if you will, a solid disc of material that is mostly cellulose, which is a byproduct of the fermentation process. I think I can put it that way.
Yeah.
So you actually get this solid mass, kind of looks like a flat jellyfish.
Apropos for where we are.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It is very appropriate for me.
And so once you have it, you want to continue to feed it. It in and of itself will replicate the process. You could technically take 100% of the liquid out and put in new. It's just not advisable, and you tend to get better results, right, if you leave 20-25% of the original liquid in. But this thing is a living raft of material. The cellulose is not alive. It's a byproduct. But as long as you've got that, and you can cut it up into pieces and move it into other jars. And
give it to your friends when they leave you. You know, one of the sort of most romantic thoughts that I always have is when cooks leave, we give them vinegar. You know, we give them mother, and our hope is that whether they're going from Vancouver or to LA or Seattle, that they'll start their own vinegar basements.
Which will taste different where they are. Of course. Every place that you go, it's going to taste a little bit different.
And they'll take some of our mother and they'll start their own project from that. You know, it's not, it's about sharing it. You know what I mean? I think it's a really, you know, like you always hear these stories about great, 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 great grandma's yogurt culture was carried over on this ship, and it's lived on through these hundreds of years. Or the greatest sourdoughs in the world are based on recipes that traveled the continent via horse and ended up in San Francisco and have been here for 200 years. You know,
But Jane, people are so disappointed I've actually known somebody who went to San Francisco to live several months just to make starters, and you know, because of the area, what's in the air, and what's and then, you know, then try to bring, take them back to where he was from in the East, and of course they changed. They didn't die, but they changed.
Yeah.
And within 6 months, it wasn't San Francisco sourdough anymore. Oh, you can't. It's a terroir industry, you know, unless you're going to control it utterly, you know, and scientifically. But what fun's that?
Yeah, I mean, there's another step of the process that we don't necessarily do. You know, if you wanted to speed up the process at home, and you happen to have a fish tank, you could speed it up really fast
by aerating it.
Exactly, and a lot of chefs are doing that now, which I don't necessarily consider cheating, but it's like bad winemaking. You know, anyone can turn grape juice into wine. You know, you can heat it up, you can add sugar, you can add water. You know, heck, you can make it in prison with grapes, but it's not a delicious wine unless you.
How do you know that?
Well, it was a long time ago.
Okay, good. I'm glad.
It was Singapore. I was chewing gum.
Oh, God. So, but the aerating, I mean.
So the aerating does speed up the process. You could, in theory, get a vinegar in like 4 days, you know, if you pop this little fish pump into the your vessel.
I don't like it.
I don't either.
On top of that, you got those systems always have sanitation issues involved in them. They're you know, you can't walk into a pet store. I mean, you can do it.
Yeah.
And I've done it, and you've probably done it.
Yeah.
But I don't hold to that.
Yeah. And
if you can't wait 4 months, don't do it.
Right. It's definitely worth it. You know, and we're experimenting now with some newer style vinegars, and we're calling them Dutch vinegars, and they're based just on a malt, and then we let them go through their own sort of beering process and then their own vinegaring process after it. So imagine like a tray, you know, 10 feet long, only 12 inches deep, full of essentially wort or what else do people call it? Mash, you know?
Right.
So you take grains, whatever your grain bill is, wheat, barley, blah, blah, blah.
I'm from the South, so we'll throw some corn in there.
Boil it, you know, at a specific temperature, 123 for us, you know, around an hour and a half, 2 hours. Let it sit, pull off all the sediment, take that liquid and just put it in the tray, put it in the attic and forget about it. And what we like is we're taking the idea of a lambic or a sour ale, you know, a Belgian sour ale, and we're applying it to the vinegar, but from beginning to end. So we've had some really interesting results.
So you put it, you got it in a tray because you want the air service. So you're treating it like ale, basically. Do you chill the wort after you make it like you would beer, or are you just literally pouring it hot directly into this? into this tray.
We don't ever let it get fully cool. We just let it cool down to room temperature.
Okay, but and you're not chilling it. You're not stairs. Icing it down like you might if you were really making beer.
Yeah.
And then you take it and you leave it. So it's you're making, in that case, you're generating a top fermenting ale, essentially. Okay.
But 100% wild fermentation.
But 100% wild fermentation.
Exactly. And I think the interesting thing for us, too, is back to the fish pump. I like oxidized wines. I love the wines of the Jura. I love orange wine, Vanjoun. I think there's a really awesome
Vanjoun's
character.
Fantastic.
It's stunning stuff, you know. The Clavelin, it's the only bottle, you know, recognized for that leader in all of Europe. I mean, they created a bottle just for this special wine, whose oxidation and, you know, Angel's Share essentially dedicated it to be 62 centiliters. But anywho, I like that flavor, and that's really what I wanted to emulate in this vinegar. You know, I like the idea of a little bit of extra oxidation, not speeding up the reaction, but
What is the flavor of oxidation? What is that? Describe it. The flavor of it.
I like it to think of it like as the opposite of oak. You know, when I think of oak, I think of like spice, smoke,
vanilla,
clove, vanilla, butter. When I think of oxidation, I think more rust. I think more like toasted flour. I can't help but associate it with white wine flavors, you know, because I get a little bit of that like vintage, you know, Montrejet kind of thing. It's like an imperceptible second or third flavor inside of, the Chardonnay.
And yeah, the first word you used was rust.
Rust, yeah. Rusty.
Have you ever tasted rust?
Haven't you?
Well, I have, in fact, tasted rust. I've got a thing for bitterness, and I've got a thing for metallic flavors.
Yeah.
Which is why, for instance, I don't like Chardonnays. I like Chablis.
Ah.
But then I also like flint, rock, mineral. I'm just kind of that way. But I understand what you mean about oxidation. And I remember being chided, I guess is the word I'll use, in culinary school when the wine instructor poured out some wine and said, we're not going to have this. It's oxidized. And I was drinking. It was like, I like this.
I actually love it.
Yeah. Can I have that?
Yeah.
So I guess I'm lowbrow. All right. So keep going. The beer, you stick it up there in the attic or wherever for how long?
We're only on 4 months on this project. So we're not fully at a finished place, but
how do you know when you are? How do you know when it's done?
Well, you know, we smell it. And if we smell the acidity, you know, I think acidity is completely perceptible, especially by the nose. And we keep pHing it. And when we get it down to a level where it's safe for everyone to consume, I'll let everybody taste it. I'm tasting it now all the time, but, you know, I'm allowed to.
Have you ever tasted something and gotten sick from it?
Vinegar-wise, no.
Let's jump over. And I want to talk something that I am got a deep passion for, noodles.
Yes.
Ramen in particular. Mm. What made you think that you could pull off Noodle Cat? How long has Noodle Cat been around now?
3 years.
Okay, so tell me about the impetus of being where you are, which is Cleveland, Ohio.
Ohio.
Hey, we need some ramen around here.
Well, Amelia and I lived in New York for a while. Mm-hmm. We started our young family there, and we really enjoyed sort of these affordable ramen suppers that now are everywhere in New York, but we're sort of, you know, Rara Ken was really the biggest one that was around.
Ramen has had has blossomed
in
New York, with Ivan Ramen and places like that.
Oh, yeah. And we made the pilgrimage, actually, to Ivan Ramen in Tokyo. It was awesome. We move home. We have a family. We have taste memories in New York of many things, ramen included. And we're of the mindset that, you know, we're not going to allow, you know, the nation to think that Cleveland is like this Siberian state that is 10 years behind and, you know, just saw Levi's for the first time and Lake still is on fire and we're just crawling out of caves now. So we said, you know, let's get ahead of the country and let's open a ramen shop in Cleveland, making our own noodles, having local partners, buying some noodles. And so Noodle Cat was born. You know, we went to Tokyo. We did like a for us, I think it's really important to be experiential, you know, not be a regurgitation of a meal that we had in New York. You know, if we're going to open a Mexican restaurant, we're not going to go to Chicago and eat around and then say, okay, we know Mexican food. We're going to go to Mexico and we're going to travel and we're going to ask friends. And if we feel like we're confident enough to do that concept, we'll do it. So that's what we did with the tavern, and that's what we did with Noodle Cat, and that's what we're doing, you know, now with Trentina, is basing it on the region and the peoples and the experiences that we had, but with farmers that we have in our backyard. And I think it creates a very simple restaurant plan for us. You know, it's something that we really understand now. Is we go to Tokyo, we realize that there's certain things that we could never do, or that we could never pull off, or that we could never source, or, you know, people that have worked their entire lifetime, you know, to make the absolute perfect tsukemon dipping sauce. And we would never be able to do that.
You see a lot of that in Japan that worked all your life to perfect this one thing.
Yeah.
I only make this type of silken tofu. It's all I do and nobody else did. Right. That's Japanese.
Yeah. I mean, and they take everything to that level, you know. Yes. Well, these are American jeans. You know what? Let me spend my entire life to make Japanese jeans that are even better than these American jeans.
Yeah. They're fanatical about it.
And I love the reverence and I love the culture for it. So we took a little bit more lighthearted approach, you know, my wife, being the genius that she is, named it Noodle Cat, you know, fun, playful, idea of like the Nekomani saying hello and goodbye to you. Uh-huh. Good fortune.
The little cat with the little arm that moves. Yeah. Left or the right, depending.
And so I think what we found out early is we tried to be a little bit, I don't want to say traditional because it would seem wrong of me to even say that, you know, being the gaijin that I am. We tried to be Tokyo with the noodles. I'll say that.
As much as I ever could.
And, you know, what we realized is it was a little
bit. Barbarian that you are.
Yes. Yeah. As I'm, as I'm being chastised for being too loud in the streets of Shinjuku.
Ooh.
Very, you know, your husband is very loud. So anyhow, true story that happened in public, in front of people.
I love that.
So,
but it's reverential. You're obviously trying to harken back to what at least your interpretation of an authentic experience is.
So we started with 100% alkaline noodle that we were producing, and then
what's a 100% alkaline noodle?
So an alkaline noodle is what ramen is. It's the reaction of these alkalines to wheat, flour, and water that creates the color and the chewy texture of ramen.
Coagulant, kind of. I mean,
We'll you can use, you know, you can make noodles with blood. You can make noodles with hot water. You can make noodles with egg. You know, there's every country has, you know, noodles. Every country has noodles.
Ubiquitous.
So, and the Chinese thing for ramen is some egg and some alkaline. So we've gone through all these different iterations of noodles. Now we use Sun. I think they do a phenomenal job. They have two or three different noodles they do for us, and they're all alkaline noodles. But I think really the point was that the genesis of this restaurant was, you know, opening it and then adapting to our city, to our street, you know, to 234 Euclid, to that address specifically. We listened to our customers, and we understood that they weren't ready for a tsukemon. You know, we put it out in the beginning, and people thought it was like salad dressing on the side. And they would pour it over top, and I could just see, you know, if a Japanese person walked in right now, I would be caned.
Tell us the right way to do it.
So the right way to eat tsukemon is to have this beautiful, fishy, oily, toasted sesame, porky, whatever your interpretation is, dipping sauce that's intensified to the point that you wouldn't put it on the ramen. You would actually pull your ramen noodles out separate, slurp them through, you know, just to get a little bit of that dipping sauce, and then you would enjoy it like that.
You would never bring the sauce to the noodles. You always bring the noodles to the sauce.
Yes, exactly. Just like a good soba noodle as well, you know, with a chilled dashi, or as we call it sometimes, super dashi on the side. It's just that experience that maybe we didn't understand yet.
Well, you've probably been to a sushi bar where you saw somebody pour the soy sauce all over the fish, you know. I mean, Well, it's an easy thing to do. Because in America, we dress salads. We're used to putting sauce on things, not things into sauce.
Exactly. Yeah, I guess that's interesting. Maybe next time I have a salad, I'll pull out a little piece of Lola Rosa and dip it into the dressing.
I don't know, man. I don't know. I think you should just dress the salad and call it a day.
I'll keep it to the household.
Yeah.
So I think that was the important. I mean, I think that's the important part of being a restaurant, you know, owner, operator, chef, dishwasher, whatever it is you have to pay attention to your city, to your streets, to your people, to your farmers, and you have to be able to have, you know, to not be too prideful and say, you know, my way or the highway. I don't believe in that mentality, especially in kitchens or restaurants anymore. You know, I think it's.
And yet you and I have both seen that.
Absolutely. And was brought up in some of the meanest, most overbearing kitchens you could imagine.
And there's no reason to name names, but there's not.
There isn't. And you know, that's actually, speaking of naming names, that's one of the best things I ever learned from Mike Simon was, you know, it's the old adage. If you don't have something nice to say, you just don't say it. The people you like and you love, you talk about all the time. The people you don't like,
to heck, don't mention it.
No necessary.
They're gone.
Yeah.
Would you say that your success, you know, because I look at your businesses, it seems that most of what you do is out of the engine that drives you is curiosity. To a great degree.
Yeah, I would.
Because you either go and find something somewhere, you go to Tokyo and have this bowl of noodles and then find a way to take that experience back and grow it anew. Just kind of like a sourdough starter. I can go get my idea starter in Tokyo, but I got to bring it back here and allow the natural surroundings to work on that idea. So it's actually a perfect metaphor for making a vinegar or fermenting anything else. You go get an idea someplace, you bring it back, you allow it to ferment in its natural terroir.
Yeah.
You bring it back, you put it where it is, you say you've got to use those farmers, you've got to use, you know, it has to become specific to where you are. You even said down to the address.
Yeah.
Your business plan is essentially making vinegar. You realize that.
I guess I never really thought about it like that. It's
the same thing.
I'm inside of the equation, you know? For me, it's what's the next book I can read? What's the next podcast I can listen to? What's the next experience I can have?
What are you reading?
What am I reading right now?
Well, I only ask this because I look at a guy who has the art from the original hardcover edition of Catcher of the Rye on his forearm, taking up a good bit of it, in fact. I've got to think that reading is probably your biggest influence in your head.
Save for every magazine publication you could ever imagine the world around, from Fool Magazine to to Savoir to Food and Wine. Those are obvious. You have to read those to stay up on today. I'm reading right now actually a vegan cookbook called From Earth to Plate, and I just think it's a fascinating little book. I love vegetables. I love eating vegan. I love eating meat. It's just a interesting, part of America. And I'm listening to Dan Carlin, and I listen to him so much. And if he's listening, I wish you would do more. I know you're busy, but I need some more hardcore history because it's my favorite.
History's good.
So good.
What are you reading that is not food related? I'm always interested in what people put into their heads besides what they put in their heads with their work.
You know, I read Wendell Berry all the time. I have like 3 copies on my bedside. I think it's good to sort of fall asleep to some of his words. I write a lot as well. So I have like a, 5 years in one line journal that I write in every day. And besides the obvious, culinary journal, what I have to do today journal. I know I have lots of paper. I tried to give up paper a while ago. I couldn't do it.
I never will. I'm way too into paper.
Yeah. And I remember what I write. I don't remember what I type at all. I could type something right now and forget it in a second.
Whenever I want to memorize, I used to do this a lot. I used to memorize recipes a lot. I would have to write them down by hand, typically 3 times, and then I could get it. It's like if you're doing demos or stuff, you're like, oh my gosh, I got to memorize this big procedure. My demo tomorrow, I haven't done it in a while, I've forgotten it. I'll sit down tonight and I'll write it over and over. Typing it does not count. It's got to actually move through my hand, through ink or a pencil, onto a piece of paper. I don't know why.
It's a crazy alchemy of mind and eyeballs and pen and paper. I love it.
I think that in order to actually make your hand move to make letters requires a part of your brain that just captures things more. It's like a net with a tighter weave on it or something than it is for typing.
That was some poetry. I love that.
Thanks, man. I just pulled that right out of my butt without any trying at all. So we're both here for Monterey Bay Aquarium for Cooking for Solutions. You did an event last night. What'd you do?
So last night we did this dish called a goujonette of lake perch.
Explain what a goujonette is.
So a goujonette, for us, our interpretation of the goujonette is equal parts potato puree, cured lake perch, and patate jus. So it's a fancy fish stick, really, is what we're talking about. And the curing process for the fish was sort of one of those, American, Japanese things that we do that we sort of sneak in. And we cured it with a glutaminate salt that we make. It's dehydrated seaweed, kombu specifically for this one, that we pulverize with real salt. And it the natural MSG inside of there just takes that perch to a whole different level. It takes anything to a whole different level.
It does.
But takes the perch to a whole different level. Yeah. And I think that people, much like the city, much like the lakes, much like, the me against the world Cleveland mentality that we have, I think people will think of perch and they're like, oh, where's the tuna? Where are the scallops at? And I thought it was kind of fun to take this fish that people, unless you're from the region, I don't know if you've had yellow perch out of Lake Erie.
I have, but
so I thought it was pretty fun to serve, 1,200 people a goujonette of lake perch. And then we did like a sauce grabiche and then we did a farm egg botarga on top of it as well that we make at the restaurant from our chickens.
How do you make a farm egg botarga?
This is, this is like what all the cool kids are doing now. Mullet roe and tuna roe are so expensive and so rare. And they have this just wonderful. One of my favorite sandwiches in the world, I swear to you, is salty and crackers, soft butter and botarga.
What's wrong with that?
It's just the great. If you haven't done it, go to the grocery store. Do not stop.
Well, most people can't
make that sandwich.
Most people can't go to the grocery store and get the Targa.
Well, you know, there's this crazy thing called the internet.
And it's not like it's going to go bad.
Yeah, no.
It's a big stick of it's jerky made out of fish eggs.
Exactly.
But how do you do that from a farm egg?
So for farm eggs, what we do is we do, depending on the size of the egg and depending on the chicken, anywhere from 12 to 16 hours just in salt. And we've also done a sweet application as well. We can come back to that. So we do 12 to 16 hours, just 100% in salt, just the yolks. And at that point, they're malleable. They're like Play-Doh. So that's when you have the opportunity as a chef.
So are you literally like putting them in, what kind of vessel are you putting them in to salt them?
I mean, you know, a bowl.
Just a bowl. And you're covering them, you're like basically burying them in salt.
Burying them full on, like you're burying them in sand.
Are you using kosher salt or what do you
I like to use
you don't want to bust the yolks.
Yeah.
You don't want to break
the yolks. I like to use fine real salt.
Okay.
I think that there's a nice minerality to it that you can't really get from any other salt.
Okay. And you need more surface contact, which that gives you.
Yeah. And so at that point it'll be like Play-Doh, you know. So you take it out, we give it a quick rinse with vinegar. You can just rinse it in water or you can rinse it in vinegar, but at that point you can do anything you want to it. You know, it's malleable, it's safe to consume. But what we did for last night's was we stacked them all, which is what we'll do typically, and we wrapped them in cheesecloth and then hang them for 3 weeks, and that gets it to the grating point. But back to the flavoring point, you know, there's been times where we've added kombu seaweed to it and put little layers in the middle and had a seaweed botarga. And there was a Bocuse d'Or event we did where we did a black Perigord truffle botarga that was stunning. And all we did was to take raw truffle and puree it with this, you know, egg yolk Play-Doh. And then the ending is the same. You hang it for 3 weeks. And then it was this black, you know, just umami bomb of truffle that was the most interesting flavor I think we created maybe in the past 2 years. And then there's another one that we do regularly at the restaurant for a beef jerky bucatini that is smoked. And I think that's the one that people love because it's a really familiar flavor. You know, we're talking about beef jerky in the pasta and then the beef jerky of the chicken egg being grated over top.
Jerky.
I love bringing it to events too because it's a great conversation piece because people see it and they either have no idea what it is or they think it's the biggest piece of botarga they've ever seen in their entire life. You know, they're like, whoa. Where did you get that botarga?
What fish did that come out of? It's called a chicken.
Yeah, exactly. It's a biped. They love to eat fish, by the way. Salmon spines are my fish, chickens. My chicken's favorite food is salmon spines. Like, they are the happiest girls. They'll just devour them. Yeah. So anywho, and then you can be fancy with these, you know, you can be fancy with the eggs. Like, you can wrap them in acetate and they can be a perfect sphere, or you can put a whole bunch of them in a ham sack and have a really wide one.
So you can put 20 of these things in it.
Yeah.
You can put as many together as you want.
Yeah.
After you've rinsed them.
Yeah, exactly. And we do typically like a dozen, you know, that yields about a, you know, 6 to 8 inch stick of botarga, which is more than enough, you know, for many sandwiches of saltine crackers and soft butter.
Mm. Sounds pretty fantastic. Jonathan, thanks for being on the show, man.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Enjoy the rest of the conference.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for letting me nerd out with you.
It was a pleasure. Hey, food fans, if you've got a weakness for funny food songs, large and unusual culinary demonstrations and puppets, you might want to catch my live touring show, The Edible Inevitable Tour, which is coming to a town near you. Just go to www.altonbrowntour.com and click on shows to find out where you can catch the action.